Searching the Scriptures with Watchman Alexander, Episode 33.
Is everybody in the world going to die before someone finds the answer?
Do I have to remind you that theory is the beginning of the solution?
What are we up against? Is it a dangerous thing?
All I've ever known to be true is a lie.
I didn't say it would be easy. I just said it would be the truth.
I believe this is going to be our finest hour.
Welcome to Searching the Scriptures with Watchman Alexander, where we break away from religious systems and man-made dogma to learn the Word of God from an independent Hebraic perspective. And now your host, the prophecy buff who tackles the tough stuff, Alexander Lawrence.
Hello and shalom. This is Watchman Alexander. This episode is a solo episode. I unfortunately do not have Terry with me today, and not for lack of trying. We recorded this entire episode, and then because of some sort of strange technical glitch on my end, the audio did not get recorded. Terry's got recorded, but mine didn't, so we lost the whole episode. So here I am by myself doing take number two, and we have already recorded the next week's episode, which came through fine. There was no problem with the audio files, so we do have next week's episode already lined up, but I apologize for the break. We actually had to take a week off because of the fall Moedim, the appointed times. There was just so much going on there that we didn't have time to sync up and record. So we lost that week, and then because of the technical stuff, we lost the next week. That's why there's been a couple of weeks where you haven't heard from us. But with that being said, I hope everybody who is observing the fall holy days had a good time at Sukkot and was really able to rest and spend good time with family and friends and get refreshed and celebrate the awesomeness that is the wedding ceremony that we're all waiting for. Because that's what Sukkot is all about. It's the honeymoon and the wedding feast. That's the whole 8-day period of Sukkot, or to be more accurate, the 7 days of Sukkot plus the last great day, which is the 8th day. That's what it symbolizes. And what an awesome thing to be celebrating and looking forward to. So as we rehearse that appointed time, I know we're making God smile. I hope that you had a lot of smiles. You had a lot of joy, because that's what it's about. It's the season of joy. We're supposed to rejoice. And my family and I certainly did our best. This was a weird year, though. I mean, 2020, right? It's just been crazy. And holding true to that, our Sukkot was a little bit scattered and weird. I wasn't able to get off work. Amanda still had to work. So I wasn't able to actually be out at the campsite as much as I wanted to. And the even bigger problem for us was that we didn't have time to prepare and get everything set up beforehand. And I was complaining about this to a few people while I was out there, that we live in a society where we get, and this really relates to the weekly Sabbath as well. It's not just these special days like Sukkot. It's the fact that we don't get off on Friday. Instead, we get off on Sunday. Well, Sunday is the first day of the week. We don't need that day off. What we need off is Friday, because that's called Preparation Day. And we're supposed to be preparing for the Sabbath. So we have everything ready and set aside that we're going to need during that day, so we don't have to do any work and we can just rest and relax on the Sabbath. So instead of having a Saturday and Sunday weekend like we do in this modern day world, as God's people, we really should have Friday and Saturday as our weekend, and we don't. And that makes it really difficult. And this Sukkot was just a good example of that, because I had to work up until the last minute. And then, well, you know, I didn't even work till the last minute. I took off from work early when I still had things to be accomplished so that I could go out and set up the tent and put together Ezra's bassinet and other stuff. That process takes hours, you know, and not to mention getting food together and grilling stuff, et cetera, et cetera. So I actually crossed over into the night hours. I crossed into the Sabbath day, which was both this year. It was both the seventh day of the week, and it was a high Sabbath, so to speak, or, you know, that special first day of Sukkot. So I was still setting stuff up. I tried going as fast as I could so that wouldn't happen, but it just didn't work out. So I was still setting stuff up during that the beginning of that Sabbath. And I felt terrible about that. I don't want that to happen. But at the same time, I have to have grace on myself. And, you know, you guys probably find yourself in the same situation sometimes too. And I want you to understand that as long as we're trying our best, if work prevents us from being able to completely prepare in time for Sabbath, and we have to go over into it a little bit, you know, I have to imagine God understands that. And he's very lenient on those kinds of things, because what can we do? You know, we're living in Egypt. We're under the bondage of this culture and this society that we're in. Hopefully, at some point in the future, things will change where we have an actual preparation day where we're not doing our regular work. But for right now, we do the best we can. And, you know, have a little grace with yourself, but also still try your best. I know God knows our hearts, and he knows if we're actually trying or if we're just, you know, making excuses or whatever. But on the bright side, our son Ezra, who's only 4.5-ish months old right now, he did really well sleeping outside in our tent during Sukkot. And that was a big surprise for us, because he seems to need a very consistent routine and schedule. And so we thought, oh, this is going to be kind of bad. He's not going to be able to sleep out there because of the noises in a different place. And you know, it's just going to be different sounds, different temperatures, and all of that stuff. And thanks be to God, that was not an issue. He went to sleep and slept just fine out there, even when there were other people who were still up in campsites beside us making a lot of noise and all that stuff. So that was wonderful, a real blessing. Of course, we didn't get to get together with people later in the evenings as much as we would have liked, because Ezra had to be put to bed and someone had to be there to watch him. Nonetheless, as a first-time Sukkoter, that's not a word, as our first time at Sukkot with an infant, it went really well. But we're through with the fall holy days, and we're looking forward to Hanukkah next. If you're interested in sending out Hanukkah cards, if that's something that you like to do, please go check out my Zazzle page, because I have custom-made Hanukkah cards on that Zazzle marketplace. And you can just go to my website, watchmanalexander.com, and go to the goods page of that website, and you'll see a link to my Zazzle marketplace. And on there, you'll find you know, apparel and other things that I've made available. And one of those things is Hanukkah cards that I designed. And I also have another card that's for later. It's for the Feast of First Fruits, or Resurrection Day. So that might also be something good for you to grab while you're at it, because that'll be coming up before we know it. And it's great to be prepared for those things already. I particularly like that card because it helps people who have not heard of the association between the Feast of First Fruits and the resurrection of Yeshua, and how those two things are one and the same. It not only is a good way to say Happy Easter without saying Easter, because it's the name of a pagan goddess, but it's a way to help Christian family and friends to understand that a little bit more, and feel like, you know, there's an alternative way to observe that special thing, which is the resurrection, which obviously we want to be celebrating and observing, but we want to be doing it in the right way. Okay, that was a big preamble. Sorry, we're going to get into our content now. And most of this is going to be Q&A, actually. I want to continue the Q&A from last time, which was talking about the Jubilee cycle and how long is it, 49 or 50 years. But before we do that, I want to go through Genesis chapter 4, at least most of it, so as to make sure that we're continuing our walk through the book of Genesis. So Genesis chapter 4 is about Cain and Abel and the famous story of Abel's death at the hands of Cain because of Cain's jealousy. You probably know the story. You can go read it for yourself if you need a refresher. But essentially, Cain and Abel were both bringing an offering to God. Abel's was proper because it was the first of his flock that he was offering. It was the prime pick of the flock, whereas Cain's offering was not acceptable because it was wrong in some way. But we're not told exactly what was wrong with Cain's offering. It may have been that he needed to be offering an animal instead of produce. It may have been that it just wasn't the first fruits and God was expecting the first fruits at that time. Cain gets angry because his offering is not accepted and he kills Abel. There's a couple things we could talk about in regards to this story. One concerns who Cain's wife was, because we're told he took a wife. But where does she come from? Genesis doesn't tell us. And because of that, a lot of people have conjectured that there could have been other humanoid creatures on the earth, or humans that didn't really have the soul that Adam had, something like that, advanced primates. I don't know. There's a lot of theories out there. None of them really carry any weight because there's not enough evidence. But the idea is that there was somebody else on the earth for him to go and marry, which is very strange, considering the emphasis that Genesis puts on the fact that Adam and Eve were the first human beings and doesn't say anything about others being created. And they seem to have just been, you know, alone on the earth. But you can't really prove that because Genesis doesn't give us enough detail. However, if you go to the Book of Jubilees, we find it explicitly stated that Cain took one of his sisters, and it names the sister that he took to be his wife. You might say, oh, well, I thought it was only Cain and Abel who were alive at that time. Well, we know that Cain was the firstborn of all of Adam and Eve's children, but we're not really told anything about the birth order of the rest of their kids. And if you look down towards the end of this segment of Genesis, you find it says that Adam and Eve had other children. So they had a larger family than what's portrayed, but we're just not given the details about when those people were born. And it would seem that, yes, there were female children that had been born that Cain was able to pick from when he left to go out and be on his own. And he was concerned about somebody finding him wandering the earth and killing him out of a sense of vengeance. And he got a special mark on him to prevent anyone from doing that. So who would those people be that would kill him? I think it makes perfect sense to say that it would have been family members. And he understood that there would be multiple generations and that some of those descendants, you know, as people multiplied, the earth would fill up more and more. He would still be alive. And some of the descendants of his brothers and sisters would want to avenge their grandfather, great-grandfather, or whatever. So he gets this mark, and we're not told what the mark is, but evidently it's something that everybody would know. Everyone would not know what that mark was unless they came from the same family. So that is actually some support for the idea that Cain's wife came from Adam and Eve's family, because all of those people were privy to the same knowledge. Evidently there was some sign, there was some mark that they knew about that God could use that would protect Cain. So I don't really buy into this whole thing that there were other people or advanced primates or something that he could have gone and mated with. But the more interesting thing to talk about in this passage is the relationship with Yahweh and the way that they were bringing an offering to him. Because what this tells us is there was already a law. God had already given instructions regarding interactions between humans and God. They were having to offer sacrifices in a certain way, which means they had received instruction in how to do that, including the kind of altar to build. There are instructions for how to make an altar properly. You can't use a tool on it. You can't chip at the stones. You can't shape the stones. We're told that in the Torah. God doesn't change. He would have expected the altar to be built the same way back then as it was expected in the days of Moses and the Mosaic Covenant. But more than that, Cain complains about being cast out of the presence of Yahweh. Here he says, I won't be able to bear being cast away from your face or driven away from your face. What this means is that Yahweh was present because Yahweh talked to Cain. Even after he had committed sin, Yahweh was there talking to Cain. So Cain and Abel were bringing an offering to Yahweh and expecting that Yahweh's presence was manifest in some sense, that he would actually be able to receive this offering and that they would have a kind of communion with him. So whether this was through an angel or whether Yahweh was speaking directly, I don't know. My guess, though, would be that there were already instructions for some kind of a tabernacle. I think probably they had set up a building or a tent of some kind that had a sectioned off area where sacrifices were made and a sectioned off area that was consecrated unto Adonai, and that his presence would actually dwell there in some way. I don't know if it was as much as it did in the Temple of Solomon or in the Tabernacle of Moses, but his presence would be there in some sense, which is why Cain was saying to Yahweh, you know, I don't want to be cast out from that. It's too much to bear. That's very fascinating to me, and I think it's something we need to recognize, is that God had given instructions in the very beginning. It's not just that the law was created later. There was already laws in place. We're just not told about how the laws were given and exactly what they were. But God has been operating the same way throughout all of history. That's what it comes down to. And we need to be careful that we don't ever think that God changed and did away with his laws. And if he was giving laws back before the Mosaic Covenant, then there are laws that still exist based on his moral character, his unchanging character today. But there are people who want you to believe that God came to a point where he said, the stuff that I was calling sin before, never mind, it's not sin anymore. You don't even have to be under those laws. It's a whole new thing. Just love. That's it. Just like love, whatever that means. I guess everybody's free to choose for themselves. No, God's laws have been in place from the beginning. They're still in place now. Yes, there's a new covenant, but the instructions of God that are based on his moral character are still the same. It's a new covenant, same kind of laws. Some of the priesthood stuff has changed. We can't fulfill all of the Mosaic laws anymore. There are things like that to take into consideration. But in terms of the general stuff that everybody can still do, all that stuff is perfectly applicable today, just as it was to Adam and Eve and Cain and Abel. And by the way, same situation with Noah. He knew how to make sacrifices. He knew about important days on which to make those sacrifices. And he knew the difference between clean and unclean animals because he took clean and unclean on the ark in different amounts because he knew that he would need them in different amounts after they got off the ark. How did he know what clean and unclean was? Those instructions had already been given. If God called animals unclean back then, they're not suddenly clean now. They didn't just up and change. The biology of the creatures is still the same. And this is getting off onto a whole topic that I didn't mean to get off onto. But just understand, if anybody's trying to tell you that God's laws have changed, some of them are not applicable, yes, but they have not changed. So be careful about that because that can lead you into lawlessness. And Yeshua was very clear about lawlessness when he said, many, many will come to me on that day, talking about the day of judgment, and say, Lord, Lord, didn't we do this and that in your name? And he'll say, I never knew you. Away from me, you who practice lawlessness. So if you know something is part of the law of God and you don't want to follow it because you've embraced the doctrine that says that you don't have to, you may be told, get away from me, because you purposely practiced lawlessness. One more thing about Genesis chapter 4 before we go to our Q&A is that the last verse, verse 26, says, at the time of the birth of Enosh, the son of Seth, men began to call on Yahweh's name. That English translation might be misleading. That doesn't make a whole lot of sense in context. There's another way you can translate that phrase. Instead of men began to call on the name of Yahweh, it could actually be men began to profane the name of Yahweh. It could be men began to call on Yahweh's name, but the problem with that is, if you go back to the beginning of this chapter, Eve was already calling on the name of Yahweh. She was already speaking about Yahweh and saying, Yahweh has blessed us with this child. And Adam and Eve and Seth, who was a godly son, they would have been teaching their offspring to call on Yahweh in the same way and to pray to him, to rely on him, to trust him, and to do the things that he's asked. So this verse, as it's usually translated, doesn't seem to make any sense. Like, they've already been doing this. Why did it start supposedly at the time of Enosh? What does that even mean? Well, maybe it means something that I'm just not thinking of right now. That's totally possible. But it seems to me in context to make more sense to say men began to profane his name at this point. Everybody was believing in Yahweh, understood that he was the creator, understood he was good up until this point. And then there were some who were casting doubt on his character. As more generations were born and they had less contact with Adam and Eve, they weren't being, maybe they spread out and they weren't there around the place of the tabernacle or the temple or wherever that central worship place was, where Yahweh's presence was manifest for Abel and Cain. Maybe the generations got numerous enough that they were spreading out and they weren't near that anymore. And so that gave Satan the opportunity to come in and start to turn hearts and minds against their creator. I think that's much more likely because Genesis then goes on to describe the decline of humanity. Anyway, this just highlights how we have to look at the Hebrew. We can't just read the English because most of the English translations say, call on the name of Yahweh. So you can look at multiple English translations and still not necessarily get the right idea because of the bias or just the tradition that the translators are working within.
Now it's your turn to direct the conversation. It's listener Q&A.
Now we can get back to our discussion about the Jubilee cycle. Is it 49 years or is it 50? If you didn't hear the last episode, I highly recommend you start there because we are in the middle of this discussion. And last time I revealed that I do believe the Jubilee cycle is 49 years, but it is possible that there is a separate 50-year cycle as well. I say maybe because that's not something that I concluded. I haven't researched it carefully enough to be able to really say one way or the other yet. I just see some things that hint at that. And I'll talk about that just briefly in a little bit. Let's start out by defining the Jubilee just for those who don't know or may have forgotten. The Jubilee is the year when everything is released. The slaves are released, and by that, really, indentured servants are released, debt servants, debt slaves. Anybody who is in debt is forgiven. And the land of Israel, each parcel of land within the territory of Israel returns to its original owner. So land never totally leaves the family. It always comes back eventually to the original owners. And all of that is a type. It's all teaching us about the release at the end of the age and how the land, being the earth, which is God's, is going to go back to its original owner, which is Yeshua, which is humanity. And Yeshua, being the second Adam, will be king over all of that. But the rest of us also who are under him will be co-heirs, okay, co-owners of the earth, and in particular, the promised land. But yet all of that has to be released from Satan and return to its original owners. And then Yeshua will even return eventually on a Jubilee, return everything over to God the Father so that God may be all in all. So the Jubilee is announced on the 49th year. That's the end of 7 times 7 years or 7 Shemitahs. And it's announced on the Day of Atonement with a trumpet blast. In the agricultural society of Israel, that 7th month, which is the month in which the Day of Atonement happens, was a harvest month. And it was also the month to begin preparing the ground to plant the barley seed before winter. So once the Shemitah year or the Jubilee year, both of which were years in which the land had to rest, the Israelites could not sow anything that year. The people knew to leave the ground fallow going forward from the Day of Atonement. Now, the actual year of Jubilee probably doesn't start until the month of Abib, because that's declared in Scripture to be the first month. But at the same time, you simultaneously really could consider there's a separate year that starts at the Day of Atonement and goes until the next Day of Atonement. And that would be the time period during which there would be no sowing. In which case, we could say that the year of Jubilee actually starts toward the end of the 49th year and overlaps the 50th year. That whole thing just isn't very clear for us in Scripture. All we know is that the announcement comes on the Day of Atonement. We don't know when the actual Jubilee is considered to have begun. That's one of those practical things. You know, it was practiced in a certain way that we're no longer privy to. And I haven't found any proof in historical documents that it was done one way or the other. In any case, I wanted to present you with some particular pieces of evidence that help us to understand why the cycle is 49 years and not 50 years. In other words, it's inclusive counting. When you get to the 50th year, that's also the first year of the next cycle. You don't add on a 50th year that's not included in the cycle to come. And I talked about that in the last show and how it relates to the counting between the day of first fruits of the barley and the day of first fruits of the wheat, and how there are 7 sevens in there, you know, 7 weeks. And then the 50th day is Pentecost or Shavuot. And that day is also the first day of that week. And you don't push the first day to the day after Shavuot or Pentecost. That would mess up your whole system of weekly Sabbaths. It would offset the Sabbath so that it wasn't every 7th day after that. So we know that that is an inclusive counting system. Why wouldn't the Jubilee also be an inclusive counting system? Well, here's some additional evidence for that. The Book of Jubilees provides us a couple of different passages in which we can use the numbers that are given to see that it's a 49-year cycle. I'll just mention one of them, which is towards the beginning of the book. It's in chapter 4. And starting in verse 29, we read this, Quote, "And at the close of the 19th Jubilee, in the 7th week, in the 6th year thereof, Adam died, and all his sons buried him in the land of his creation. And he was the first to be buried in the earth, and he lacked 70 years of 1,000 years. For 1,000 years are as one day in the testimony of the heavens, and therefore was it written concerning the tree of knowledge, on the day that you eat thereof, you will die. For this reason, he did not complete the years of this day, for he died during it." End quote. That's verses 29 and 30. This is a great passage because it tells us two things. Number one, it tells us that a day is as 1,000 years. Moses told us that. We have that in the Psalms. And Peter reiterated it in the New Testament. But is there any other place that that's said? Because that's really not as much support as I would like to have for it. Well, I actually have more support now from the Book of Jubilees and also from the Book of Enoch and from some of the other Dead Sea Scrolls. That whole day equals 1,000 years equation is so important, as you know if you've listened to the first episode of this podcast, because it tells us how many years there are of redemptive history, and that Yeshua is coming back at the beginning of the 7th millennium. And if we can figure out kind of where we are in terms of the millenniums, then we will know approximately how close we are to the end of this age. But the other thing this passage tells us is that the Jubilee cycle is 49 years, because it gives us the number of Jubilees that had passed at the time of Adam's death. He was 930 years old. He was 70 years short exactly of 1,000 years. And 70 is an important number. We'll come back to that later. But he was 930 years old, and we're told that 18 Jubilees had passed. It was in the 19th Jubilee cycle, and that 6 Shemitahs had passed, and then they were also in the 6th year of that 7th Shemitah cycle. So you just have to do the math there with the numbers 49 and 50 plugged in and see which one equals 930. And it is the 49 that works in that equation. So 18 times 49 plus 6 times 7 plus 6. Those are the numbers we're given, and all that adds up to 930. If you do 50, 18 times 50 plus 6 times 7 plus 6 does not equal 930. So there you go, the Book of Jubilees, very clearly, you know, math is math. It has told us these are 49-year cycles. We can go outside of some of those extra-biblical scriptures to regular historical sources like Josephus and Philo, and we find the same thing. It's clear from these Second Temple sources, especially Antiquities of the Jews, that a continuous run of 7-year cycles was counted between 135 BC and AD 139. And this period of history straddles about 273 years, or 39 cycles of 7 years. During this quite lengthy stretch of history, sabbatical years were observed in the years of 135 BC, 44 BC, 37 BC, AD 55, AD 69, and AD 139. Now, the spans between these years, which we know from these historical sources, were Sabbath years. Those are all divisible by 7, never by 50. The 50-year cycle just does not work with those dates. And there's no reason to doubt that Josephus and Philo were telling the truth. They had no reason to lie about which years were Sabbath years. We can go to the Bible itself for some further support as well, because the Book of Ezekiel gives us a date on which he had a vision of the millennial temple. So Ezekiel is shown this millennial temple and describes it over the course of several chapters, and that vision initiated on a Jubilee year. Ezekiel was very careful to explicitly state which year he received the vision. He said, quote, "In the 25th year of our captivity, in the beginning of the year, in the 10th day of the month, in the 14th year after that the city was smitten, in the selfsame day the hand of Yahweh was upon me," end quote. Ezekiel chapter 40, verse 1. Since the Babylonians ultimately burned the city of Jerusalem late in the year 586 BC, give or take a year, the respective year that Ezekiel received his vision, which was 14 years afterward, would have corresponded to the year approximately 572 BC. And we can count backwards from that date by 49s or 50s to see if we arrive at any other very important dates that correspond with the Jubilee. But before we do that, let me just tell you that the Talmud and the Seder Olam both state that Ezekiel's vision was indeed received at the start of a Jubilee year, and that it was the 17th Jubilee, which affirms this very important date earlier in history, which is the date on which Israel entered into Canaan. But the difference between 1406 BC and 586 BC is divisible by 49. It's not divisible by 50. There's something else that syncs up very interestingly with this vision of Ezekiel's, and that is the vision of Haggai and Zechariah, and that is the temple visions of Haggai and Zechariah. There are two chapters in Haggai and six chapters in Zechariah, or eight total chapters, wherein they prophesy the construction of a new temple. These visions, their visions, were received in the year 521 BC, the second year of Darius II. So, because we know when those visions occurred, we can count backwards to when Ezekiel had his vision, and we find that it was about 50 years, but we can't say exactly, okay? There's not enough information to be able to nail it down to either 49 or 50 years, but what we can say is that there was a jubilee cycle that occurred between Ezekiel's temple vision and Haggai and Zechariah's temple visions. And what that does is it strongly suggests that Ezekiel's vision occurred at a jubilee, which, you know, makes us more confident that if we count backwards from there by 49s or 50s, whichever the case may be, we're going to arrive at the date when the Israelites crossed the Jordan dry shod. Why is that a date that we need to be looking at as a jubilee date? Well, the book of Jubilees actually explicitly states that it was, but also Jewish tradition says that it was. So I'm going to read from Jubilees chapter 50, starting at verse 3, quote, "And the land also shall guard its Sabbaths while they dwell upon it, and they shall know the Jubilee year. Wherefore I have ordained for you the year weeks, and the years, and the Jubilees. There are 49 Jubilees from the days of Adam until this day, and 1 week and 2 years. And there are yet 40 years to come for learning the commandments of Yahweh until they pass over into the land of Canaan, crossing the Jordan to the west." End quote. So the angel tells Moses that there have been 49 jubilees in 9 years already since Adam, and then there will be an additional 40 years of wandering in the wilderness before they can cross the Jordan, and that when they do enter the promised land, that will be the 50th jubilee. Now just for funsies, let's jump to the book of Joshua, chapter 4, and read about that event. Quote, "And the people came up out of the Jordan on the 10th day of the first month, and encamped in Gilgal, in the east border of Jericho." End quote. That's verse 19. So the 10th day of the first month, the 10th day is the Day of Atonement in the 7th month. This says the first month, although it kind of depends on how you interpret the first month. Are we talking the first civil month? Because the Jewish people treat the 7th month as the beginning of the civil year. Or are we talking about the actual first month, the month of Abib? So this could either be talking about the Day of Atonement, or it could be talking about 6 months after the Day of Atonement, exactly half a year after the announcement of the Jubilee year. And I think it's probably that one. The reason being, they encamped, they set up camp in Gilgal when they crossed. If this was the 10th day of the 7th month, that would be the Day of Atonement, they could not have done any work. Joshua, being a godly leader, would not have allowed Israel to set up camp on that day. You don't do anything on the Day of Atonement. It's a very, very set apart day of no work and afflicting yourself. So you don't do things like set up camp. It's one of the things that makes me think maybe you announce the Jubilee in the 7th month, but you don't actually enact it until the beginning of the coming year, the month of Abib. This would support that. But again, I can't prove it. There's things either way that would support either interpretation. So anyway, keep that in mind. But as a third witness, I'm going to bring in the Psalms of Joshua, which is from the Dead Sea Scrolls. It's number 4Q379, fragment 12. And the text of that scroll refers to the Israelites crossing the Jordan dryshod, quote, "in the first month of the 41st year of their departure from the land of Egypt. This was the year of the Jubilee from the start of their entry into the land of Canaan," end quote. So this, contrary to what I just said, may indicate that the Jubilee year does start on the 10th day of the 7th month, because it says that the year of Jubilee started when they entered into the land of Canaan, which is on the 10th day of the first month, but in this case, it would have to be the first month of the civil year, not the sacred year, because it would not make any sense. The scripture never indicates that we should start the year of Jubilee on the 10th day of Abib. That's just not a thing that we find anywhere. So this would have to be the 10th day of the 7th month, but again, that's a Day of Atonement. So there's a bit of a contradiction here, seemingly. I don't know how to, I'm just going to be honest with you. Like, I don't know how to reconcile these things, because how did they set up camp if it was the Day of Atonement? And why are they calling this seventh month the beginning of the year? You know, it's confusing to me that the Bible is talking about the beginning of a year and not telling us which year, if there's more than one year. We would only know through context, which is something that is true sometimes with scripture. We only know through context exactly what it's talking about. But this there's just not enough examples in scripture to me of where it would tell us you're going to have two different years. I want you to have this civil year in addition to the year that I already explicitly told you starts in Abib. I would need something more concrete in terms of that kind of an explanation first. And then going forward from that, we could say, okay, you just need to use context to determine which year. But to say we use context, but it was never explicitly stated that you would have 2 years to begin with, that makes me uncomfortable. So if anybody has ideas about how we're to reconcile these different things and figure out, was this the seventh month or the first month? I am all ears. Please let me know if you have some thoughts on this and can bring some clarity. But again, going back to the whole point, this year that they entered in was a Jubilee year, and you can get from there to Ezekiel's vision using cycles of 49. It doesn't work with cycles of 50 if our understanding of when that entry into Canaan happened is correct. If it's correct, if we have the right date, which, you know, there's a consensus about that date, but it's not necessarily completely correct. So if that 1406 date is just wrong, then we don't necessarily have a case. But if it's correct, then it works. There's 49 year cycles between that and Ezekiel's vision. So that's just, you know, evidence to take into account. I think when you add that to the other stuff that we already discussed, it makes a pretty weighty case that, yes, indeed, these are 49-year cycles. But is there a 50-year cycle as well? Because Josephus talks about this great year. You know, that's the term that's given to it, that the Jewish people were practicing what's called a great year, and it was a multiple of 50. In fact, it was 12 times 50, because it was a 600-year year. And for some reason, that was important. And in the book of Enoch as well, we see that there are cycles of 100 years that are occurring. There are other ways of measuring the passing of time, and more than one of those methods may be in use. So I don't want to just discard the idea that we may want to use a 50-year cycle when we talk about the fulfillment of certain prophecies. I just don't think that we should be using it when we're actually practicing the Jubilee and when we celebrate that. We need to be doing the 49-year cycle for that. But there is this possibility that's interesting to me, that lunar weeks can be used to define this full cycle of 50 years, and that it would restart on the year after that 50th year. Essentially, you count lunar quarters, that's a lunar week, okay? So it's from like black or no moon visible to a half a moon to a full moon, back to a half a moon, and then returning to no visibility. Though that is 4 lunar weeks, okay? That's the quarters of the lunar phases. And those lunar weeks can be used to define this period of 50 years where the phases of the moon that you began with, or the phase you began with that syncs up with the phases of the sun, you don't get back to that same synchronization until a full 50 years has elapsed. The main reason for believing that the lunar cycle was once reckoned at these lunar weeks is that ancient literature explicitly describes the priestly courses as being rotated once each week. There was a routinely appearing sign. We don't know what that sign was exactly, but there was a sign which was accounted for right when one priestly course ended. And you can refer to scroll 4QTOT for that. And the combination of this rotating schedule and the time when the sign was routinely observed doesn't allow for an alternative interpretation, meaning you can't treat those weeks as being weeks of days. These have to be lunar weeks. So essentially, if the sign was observed at the end of a week cycle, then the priests were using lunar weeks, not weeks of days. And lunar weeks can't be put together into this 49-year cycle. The year of the moon is shorter than the year of the sun, so it has a whole different cycle that it goes through over the course of many solar years. you know, it's just a mathematical fact. You can't make it work in a 49-year cycle. In fact, if you extend that out, the calendar of lunar weeks inherently requires 12 Jubilee cycles, which is 600 years, and I mean 12 50-year cycles, to complete all possible combinations of the quarter phases and to return to the same moon phase in conjunction with the annual circle. So that's really what the great year is, seemingly, is that the moon cycles and the sun cycles sync back up after 600 years. Again, you can't do that with 49-year cycles. So is there this secondary 50-year cycle that is pivotal to the moon, but really doesn't have anything to do with the sun? Yeah, that's a good possibility. But again, I have not researched this carefully enough. I have not learned enough about it to be able to tell you for certain that this is correct. I plan to look into it some more. I'd love for you guys to look into it. Tell me what you find. I could be way off base here because, you know, I just haven't studied enough yet. But I just wanted to throw out that possibility because there are people that very much think, you know, the 50 years works better in a lot of scenarios, especially when you're talking about millenniums. I mean, 1,000 years is divisible by 50. It's not divisible by 49. So maybe both of these cycles are being used at the same time. Hey, so hopefully your brain does not complete mush already at the end of this episode, but I just had to break in here from the future and explain something. Yes, I am from the future. This is not the Alex of the present timeline of this podcast. This is Alex from several days in the future. I discovered something about this whole passage in Joshua that we were discussing, and I needed to add it in here because I got some clarity. I had said that I didn't think that this crossing over the Jordan could have occurred on the Day of Atonement because they set up camp. But I reconsidered, and I believe that they didn't set up camp until nightfall had happened, until the end of the day. And the reason I'm saying that is because of the parallel, the prophetic parallel, between crossing the Jordan on this day and the crossing of the heavenly waters, the Shamayim, you know, the waters above, as we've discussed before, that is going to occur on the Day of Atonement at the end of the age. And that's also going to be the beginning of a Jubilee year. I don't know why I didn't see this before, but it's really amazing, actually. And it makes perfect sense. If we're all going to be called up in the resurrection to cross into the promised land on that future Day of Atonement, which is when the last trumpet is blasted, then wouldn't the Israelites the first time have been called across the river into the promised land at the Jubilee, at the 50th Jubilee, also on the Day of Atonement? I can't imagine that it wouldn't be that way now that I've seen it. Something in the text that helps me understand that this wasn't in the month of Abib, but instead was at the beginning of the civil year in the month of Tishri, or the seventh month, is that immediately upon crossing into the promised land, all of the males were circumcised. They hadn't been circumcised in the wilderness, so they had to be circumcised now that they were going into God's land. And it says that they waited in the camp. They just hung out until they healed from the circumcision. And then they observed Passover. But we're not told what time elapsed between the circumcision and the taking of the Passover. But there is a hint in there because it says that they used at the Passover for unleavened bread, they used the grains of the promised land, which had to be gathered. They had to go out and gather what was already growing there because they didn't have a chance to plant, especially if this was a Jubilee that we're talking about here. They couldn't be sowing. So they would have had to have gone and taken whatever was growing by itself there already, or maybe there was some little conquest that happened and they took some land that somebody else had been growing barley on. I don't know exactly what occurred there, but somehow they were using the barley crop that was already in the promised land. That couldn't have happened if they had just been circumcised, because they were sitting around healing, and that takes at least several days, maybe a couple weeks, to really truly heal from that. And you wouldn't be getting up and going out and searching the land for barley and gathering it up. You could say the women might have done that, but that would have been pretty unsafe for the women to be going out by themselves and looking for the barley and gathering that while the men were in the camp, unable to help and unable to defend them against the inhabitants of the land. So I don't think that would have happened. I think what we have here is a case of an unspecified gap of time between the fall and the spring. And during that time, they were encamped east of Jericho, and they were just waiting, because they knew God had to give them the directive to go against the people of the land before they could do anything. So they were just hanging out, healing, and waiting. There is one thing about Joshua chapter 4, verse 19, that may help us clear up the confusion regarding which year we're talking about here, and are there even 2 years at all? The Bible never explains that there are 2 years, and if it never labels the years with different terms, then how are we ever to know which one we're talking about? Those are legitimate concerns, and I think there may be an answer within the Hebrew text of Joshua 4:19, because even though in the English translations it usually says the first month of the year, it doesn't actually say that in Hebrew. It says Rosh Kodesh. Now, Rosh Kodesh really means head month. If you want to get really technical, it means head new moon, not even head month. So we could interpret that as not being the first month or the first new moon of the year. In fact, as the seventh new moon, it could indeed be considered to be the head or the king of all of the new moons, because the number seven represents God's perfection, and it's a number that is often used in the Bible to represent the qualities of divinity. So if Rosh Kodesh is basically the label for that particular month, the seventh month, then it would not be proper to translate it as the first month. It's still the seventh month. It just happens to be the head or the king of all the months. So that could clear up the confusion. We're not talking about the first month here. We're talking about the seventh month, but that month happens to be labeled Rosh Kodesh. So I think that is the interpretation that I'm going to go forward with for right now until I get some other sort of revelation. But I think this was the seventh month that they crossed the Jordan. I think it's in the seventh month on the 10th day, the same day of the year that we, who are the saints of God, are going to cross through the waters above into the heavenly realm with our King. No wonder the seventh month is called the King of the Months. Okay, that's it. I won't melt your brain anymore. Sorry for that. But I just had to share how excited I am that the entry of the Israelites way back when, and the entry of the Israelites into the heavenly realm at the end of the age, is on the same day. Very cool.
If you'd like to have Watchman Alexander answer your question in a future episode, please send an email to questions@watchmanalexander.com with your city and state or region in the subject line.
That's going to complete our episode for today. Thanks so much for being here. And until next time, be wise as serpents and harmless as doves. Watchmen out.